The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. This week in the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Kevin McCullough. Great to be with you. This week, the hearings for the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett begin. She was impressive.
I think she comes across as a cut above in the sense that she's too good for the Senate.
All Americans, left, right, and center, should be able to agree on her core convictions.
Her agenda is to maintain the integrity of the Constitution.
We'll also look at the threat of judicial activism.
Legislators have to face the voters again and again and again.
We'll look at China's increasingly threatening posture.
They don't want Christians to leave out their faith.
And the challenge to people of faith right here in the U.S.
And you're going to find it increasingly impossible to participate in public life.
We've got all this and more. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home station in New York City, where you can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon at AM 570 and FM 102.3, The Mission, and also AM 970, The Answer. Take a moment to follow me and Christian Outlook on Twitter. My handle, at KMC Radio, and the Christian Outlook, at TC Outlook. Great to be with you. We'll start in the nation's capital and the hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee for Amy Coney Barrett. She is the president's nominee to serve on the Supreme Court, filling the seat vacated by the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And for all who had even a little bit of an open mind, she was impressive. We'll turn first to Michael Goodwin of the New York Post. He was a guest on my program.
She's quite a force, and obviously they've not laid a glove on her in any way that would interrupt the confirmation process. Republicans have the votes, and she's superbly qualified, and so the hearing is just an attempt to try to poke some holes in it. But, you know, Kevin, I think it goes beyond that even, because I think she comes across as a remarkable human being as well.
Yeah.
And it's really something that you get a sense here of this hearing sometimes, and people may be good judges or good commissioners of some agency, some secretary, but I think she comes across as a cut above in the sense that she's too good for the Senate.
Yeah.
I felt like they just looked like such sleazeballs trying to bring down somebody. You know, she's clearly led a remarkable life, both professionally and personally. And as you say, she's incredibly likable. She's admirable. She seems to be unflappable. She's a person of faith. She's, seven children, my goodness, two of them adopted.
Right.
She's quite an extraordinary character. And so I think that when you see this, it goes beyond just the court. It says, wow, there are really people like this who are willing to serve our country. She was asked about that, and how did you come to the decision to be sitting here? And she said, you know, basically, you have to do these things. She said, no sane person would do this if there weren't some outcome or some benefit to it. And the benefit is to the country of that kind of service. So I'm really taken by not just her judicial philosophy, which I tend to agree with, but the person we're witnessing here. This is seems to me an extraordinary human being.
There was a lot of speculation, particularly on the right, that maybe Lindsey Graham didn't need to do the full set of hearings, maybe just come in and take an up or down vote. But he decided to go ahead and go forward with these hearings. And I think that's a distinct benefit, not just to her confirmation, but I think that this does something to the 2020 picture as well. Michael, I'm curious if you feel similarly, and if so, how do you think it impacts it?
Well, just quickly on 2018, I think the day after that midterm where the Democrats took the House, one of the first things President Trump said in his press conferences is, we picked up two Senate seats. Now, there wasn't final at that point. There may have been three, there may have been four, but he said, it's historically rare for you to lose in the first midterm for the president's party to gain Senate seats. And everyone said, oh, you lost the House. That's the news of the day.
Right.
But it turns out picking up two net Senate seats is very important for these entire last 2 years, and particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court. And so I think that Amy Coney Barrett is benefiting from the hostile treatment of Kavanaugh. And she's benefiting, I think, in some odd way from Dianne Feinstein's earlier, when she was being confirmed for the Court of Appeals, the dogma
lives loud
within
yeah.
you. So the attack on her faith, I think, was blunted by the reaction to that comment.
If you watched even a small portion of the hearings, you heard Judge Barrett defend herself with grace and discipline, making clear that she has no political agenda. But does that mean she has no agenda at all? Craig Roberts turned to Bob Zadik, a California radio host himself. They spoke on KFAX in San Francisco.
Justice Barrett has no real agenda other than to say there's no agenda. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, she has an agenda. Her agenda is to maintain the integrity of the Constitution, to decide cases on the law, not on these how sympathetic the litigants are. So I think she has a profound agenda. But it is an agenda that we wish every judge or justice in the case of the Supreme Court would have. I hope she does have an agenda, and I know she does, and that's what it is. And I profoundly respect her for having that, if you will, agenda.
Now, at 48 years old, if indeed confirmed to the High Court, she could see a potentially significant tenure on the court. If she stays virtually for lifetime, as most seemingly in recent years do, she could see 40-plus years on the High Court and certainly leave a significant indelible mark, as some of her certain predecessors would have, to be sure, down through the years. And maybe in part that's some of the concern here, that as someone who could sit on the High Court for decades to come, once confirmed, would have the opportunity to perhaps steer some of the decisions the High Court makes in certainly a more neutral direction. By neutral, I mean less politicized, less legislation from the bench, as is often levied at the court, and more based on, well, quite frankly, what else do we call it, but sort of a rational basis standard for jurisprudence, which I think would be a welcome relief given some of the other appointees down through recent memory and what some would consider to be more of a basis that the Constitution is a living, breathing thing, and therefore we have to kind of decide based on not what the Founding Fathers meant or intended, but rather what seems to be more practical or in some cases politically expedient for the now.
You said a whole lot there, Craig, as you often do. You pack a lot into a single sentence or paragraph. I want to comment and join you in saying, given her age, she could leave her mark. I think she will leave her mark, not by her age, not by the number of cases she decides, not by the number of cases she is in the majority or in the dissent. She will leave her mark by the intellect and the integrity of her decisions. You don't have to. Now, we hope she leaves a mark also for her tenure, but I assure you, she will leave a mark that future generations will be profoundly grateful for, only in her preservation of the rule of law. So yes, she will leave her mark, hopefully for both longevity and wisdom.
The goal of the textualist or the originalist judge is really quite modest. So why is it that someone like Barrett is such a threat? Here's Albert Mohler from his briefing program.
In the course of all of this, some really fascinating things have happened already. For one thing, some very basic constitutional issues are actually now rising to the fore. You've got people talking about things they don't normally talk about. The American people are actually talking about the Supreme Court and the Constitution in a way that they would not normally have such a conversation. Now, there's something also interesting in this, and in my conversation with Ilya Shapiro on Thinking in Public, released yesterday, he makes the point that social scientists scientists have affirmed that if you look at recent presidential election cycles, especially among Republican voters, there's an amazing amount of sophistication in knowing about the Supreme Court, the interpretation of the Constitution, and for good reason. Conservatives have been trying to overcome the court's usurpation of the legislative process, and in order to do that, even Republican voters are now talking about constitutional issues, which would have been hardly imaginable, say, a half century ago. But we're not now living a half century ago. We're right now. In 2020, these issues are front and center. Now, I want to point just to several things that I think are illustrative. They're just incredibly interesting in the midst of this. One comes prompted by an article in The Washington Post entitled, "Congress Can Limit the Court's Influence by Doing Its Job." It's by rather liberal columnist Jennifer Rubin. But I want to say conservatives in this case agree with her wholeheartedly. Congress has a responsibility. It has not fulfilled that responsibility. And the courts should not take up that responsibility and become a super legislature. But that's not exactly what she says. But that's what I'm going to say. But here is what she says. She says that if you're looking at threats to Roe and Obergefell and other liberal court decisions, she says the way around that just might be to eliminate the filibuster in the Senate and have the United States Congress, a Democratic majority in the House, and what they hope will be a Democratic majority in the Senate, go ahead and make Roe legislation. Now, we talked about the fact that Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee, said right out loud, that's what should happen. He said that in the course of the campaign already. But what's the point? Well, the point is this. Congress would indeed have the authority to legislate on these questions. Now, let me read to you from Jennifer Rubin's article. She says this, quote, "Instead, the first step Congress should take is get ready to legislate. It can pass a federal statute, likely to require the demise of the filibuster if it cannot be accomplished in a reconciliation bill," she's writing here, "to codify Roe." And then she goes on to say, "And if lawmakers see fit, stripping out the Hyde Amendment that limits federally funded abortions to cases of rape, incest, or cases in which the life of the mother is at risk." In other words, Rubin writes, the federal government can decide not only to protect the right to seek an abortion, but also to make abortions more accessible to poor women. We can argue whether that is a good or bad policy, but no one, she says, can argue that Congress has no prerogative to address the issue. Nor can anyone say, she writes, that Congress can't, say, pass a Defense of All Marriages Act, which would secure same-sex marriages, end quote. Now, here's where I agree with her. Conservatives have been saying this for decades now. Yes, Congress could do those things, but you know what? If Congress does those things, every single person who votes for them is going to have to live with that vote, and voters can say, out with you, in disagreement with that position. That's why Congress hasn't done this. A Democratic majority has existed for most of the years in Congress since Roe v. Wade in both houses. But a Democratic Congress didn't move forward to codify Roe v. Wade because those members of Congress and senators would have to go back and get reelected having made that vote. So here's the point. It's interesting that the left now comes up with the fact that Congress, maybe if they'd read the Constitution, they would have thought of this earlier, is actually given the responsibility to legislate. But let's ask the question, why should legislators deal with these issues rather than judges? It is because legislators have to face the voters again and again and again. They have to own their decisions and be responsible for them. The effort by so many in this country, particularly on the left, to say we want judges to decide this means they want people who will never, by constitutional definition, face voters again. That is an incredible threat to democracy.
Coming up, a warning sign for the church.
We don't want Christians to leave out their faith.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Bob Fu is the president of the Christian human rights group China Aid. He was part of the protests at Tiananmen, and he served time in prison as a result of work on behalf of religious freedom. And today, he's living in exile in Midland, Texas. And he is still being threatened by forces sympathetic to the Chinese Communist Party. Bob Fu was a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Tell us your story from a wider perspective. Talk about initially about being in China, growing up in China as a young man, and seeing the civil rights abuses that made you one of the leaders of the Tiananmen Square protests.
Yes, John. I was born and grew up under communist China and educated as atheist. And I witnessing and also experiencing how brutal this ideology of communism has inflicted to really tens of millions of Chinese citizens. And now, of course, the whole world, I witnessed this Chinese Communist Party, inflicted millions of American citizens and throughout the world with this Communist Party virus of COVID-19.
Yes. Right.
And, you know, the nature of communism is always control, control, control. It's always tyranny and in nature and with dictatorship. I mean, now the Chinese president, President Xi, declared president for life and no term limit. And you can get a 19-year sentence for basically tweeting 58 messages as one of the Chinese netizen was received. We have to rescue his wife and her baby. I mean, the baby was not even allowed to see the father because before the baby was born, the father was already imprisoned for tweeting 58 messages.
Wow.
And got 19 years imprisonment. And the pastor, one sermon can get you 9 years imprisonment, like Pastor Wang Yi of the Early Rain Covenant Church, a Presbyterian church movement leader in China, who received 9 years sentence for so-called subversion of state power because in one sermon last year, he called the repentance of President Xi for his brutal crackdown against the Christians. And on and on, you know. So there's no true freedom.
Bob, you have to be shocked and in many ways broken by what's happened here, because, I mean, here you're in hiding again. It's almost like you're back in China in 1989, and I'm sure you're fearing for your life and your wife and your children as well. You have to be shocked.
Very much so. Our whole family is kind of shocked. And, you know, children, I could tell they're a little bit traumatized even. You know, because we experienced this under communism in China. We were imprisoned. We knew that's the nature of communism in China. They just want to silence any voice of difference, and they don't want Christians to live out their faith in China. That's why hundreds of thousands are being imprisoned and persecuted every day. But we have never thought or imagined this would come to our own door in West Texas. And their sole purpose is to silence our voice for freedom and try to destroy the ability of China Aid, our ministry, to walk with the persecuted faithful in China. So, I mean, this is a very clearly kind of a defined campaign is to destroy ours. But, I mean, Don, as you know, as Christians, now maybe it's a blessing in disguise. This could serve as a wake-up call that we can no longer take our freedom in this country for granted. Mm-hmm. And the Communist Party and its influence and its thugs are in our door. And now every day, so our neighbors are really woke up. I mean, our great peaceful neighborhood, every household is just fed up. Basically, those guys are knocking door to door every day, try to spread the propaganda with Chinese Communist Party's Red Guard style tactics.
Wow.
And you can't even argue with them. They're just throw their things and said, you have to believe this. Bob Fu is a Chinese spy. He's a fake pastor. It's very, very threatening.
You can catch the complete conversation with Bob Fu and John and Kathy at ChristianOutlook.com. The totalitarian instincts of China are readily apparent. But we have some very concerning trends in our own nation that we need to pay close attention to. I turn to author Rod Dreher, author of Live Not by Lies. You talk in the book about, and I don't have my review copy, so I'm flying a little bit blind on this. Sometimes that happens, but I think I'm going to still try to ask the questions that people would have naturally of the book. But you mentioned soft totalitarianism, and this book takes a look at your fear that that is moving into the American psyche and culture. And I'm just, for context purposes, help us understand what that term means in terms of the context of how you use it.
Great. Well, totalitarianism, as a political science definition, is a system that politicizes every aspect of life. There is no aspect of life left untouched by the ideology. Now, hard totalitarianism is the kind that most of us are used to. This is what they had in the Soviet Union with gulags, KGB, prison, that sort of thing. And this is the sort of thing that we're all used to also from 1984, George Orwell's 1984. I think that what's coming to this country is a softer version of that. Unlike Orwell, where they used pain and terror to coerce people to conform with the ruling ideology. In this one, they're going to manipulate people's pleasures and their desire for status. The result is going to be the same thing, that if you don't give in, burn a pinch of incense to the Caesar, the woke Caesar, you're not going to be able to participate fully in society. That is one of the reasons why, Kevin, that it's so difficult for Christians and conservatives and other Americans to see how serious this thing is, because they're looking back to their Orwell for an example of totalitarianism when they really ought to be reading Huxley's Brave New World.
Well, and let's talk about some of the tangible signs of that. So you're obviously identifying how to live as Christians and, if necessary, dissidents. What if we're not even aware that it is slowly taking over everything that we see around us?
Well, you're going to find out when your kids, your kindergartners, come home from public school and they've been instructed in gender ideology. And you don't have the right, as they don't in California, to withdraw your kids from those classes. You're going to find it when you are suddenly compelled to go through, quote unquote, anti-racism indoctrination at your workplace, your university, your institution. And even though you may not be a racist, and none of us should want to be racist, that's not what this so-called anti-racism is. And on and on and on. And you're going to find it impossible to participate, increasingly, to participate in public life if you don't get on board with it. And I'm already having people tell me that in their universities, for example, Christian faculty are saying that they know that they're being watched, and any little thing they say that gets on the other side of political correctness is going to be held against them.
Coming up.
If you don't give in, burn a pinch of incense to the Caesar, the woke Caesar, you're not going to be able to participate fully in society.
More of my conversation with Rod Dreher when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Kevin McCullough. If you or someone in your family immigrated here to the United States from one of the nations that were under the thumb of the Soviet Union, you'll likely be immediately sympathetic to Rod Dreher's argument. Yes, you could call what we're seeing here softer, but it is still sinister, and it is still ruining lives and destroying small business. Let's return to more of my conversation with Rod Dreher. There are people, be it on social media, that with cancel culture now, if a social media influencer so much as says, hey, I like the nominee that the president put forward, the people will come burn your Etsy shop down. I mean, it is so enormous what you're describing here. And yet, because of the soft nature of it, because of kind of the implied pressure that is given, as opposed to the marching you to the gulag at the point of the gun, I don't think that a lot of people recognize it. It's shaming you. Your beliefs, similar to the gulag style that you're telling us hard totalitarianism is represented by.
They want you to feel so ashamed of what you believe to be true and know to be true that you despise yourself, and you can only have peace in your external life and peace in your inner life when you conform. And, you know, it's interesting you bring this up about the cancel culture mobs. The reason I wrote this book, Live Not by Lies, is because 5 years ago, I got a call from a doctor in the Midwest who said, listen, somebody needs to know this. My mother is very old, lives with me and my wife. She's an immigrant from Czechoslovakia. Back when she was a young woman, she had to spend 5 years in a Czech prison for her Christian faith. Now she's here with us, and she says, son, the things I'm seeing happen in America now remind me of what I saw growing up in Czechoslovakia. And specifically, she was talking about the mob that came after Memory's Pizza. I don't know if you remember that, but 5 years ago, a little evangelical-owned pizza parlor in small-town Indiana told a TV reporter who asked if you would cater a gay wedding. They said, no, of course, we'll serve gay customers, but we're not going to cater a gay wedding because we're Christians. Suddenly, they had a national mob trying to burn down their business, right? So this is the sort of thing that made me wonder, like, is this old Czech woman, is she being alarmist? But when I started talking to people in this country who had grown up under communism, I found out, no, they're seeing it everywhere, and they're so angry because Americans won't listen to them.
Rod, it strikes me as we are having this discussion and as we are dealing with this soft totalitarianism, as you describe it in the book, and I want everybody to get a copy, that there are different institutions and influences that perpetuate this. So obviously there's what the government does, so the public policy action. There's what the area of Hollywood influences, so there's entertainment and arts. There's any number of arenas, academic, financial, economic policy. There's a number of things that can all be used to manipulate, to force, to cajole, etc. I am strongly, and I can't overstate this, I'm exceedingly worried about the role that the church is having in terms of conforming to the soft totalitarianism, and in fact sometimes echoing it deeper into the realm of Christian community here in America than I would have expected. What is your reaction to, did you include anything in the book addressing the church's role, and how should pastors and leaders, spiritual leaders, be thinking about the soft totalitarianism that their congregations, their bodies, their communities that they shepherd are being subjected to?
This is an excellent question, Kevin. You know, the reason that, or one big reason why American Christians are so susceptible to this is because we have forgotten how to suffer. We have forgotten the importance of suffering as followers of Jesus. We have instead adopted the sort of Christianity that one sociologist has called moralistic therapeutic deism. It's just a belief that God exists and he wants us to be happy and nice to everybody, and that's just about it. Well, that is a nice middle-class psychological way to live out your faith, but it's also false. In Live Not by Lies, I did a lot of interviewing of Christians who had come through Soviet persecution, Soviet bloc persecution, and the most important thing they said, whether I was talking to a Baptist in Russia, Catholics, or Orthodox, they said that you have got to be willing to suffer, even die, for the sake of Christ, or you're not going to make it through. That is the thing I would say to pastors and to lay people in this country. It's that we've got to get rid of this false gospel of comfort and prosperity and be prepared to suffer the loss of status, the loss of income, and even if it comes to it, the loss of our lives, or our faith is going to be taken from us.
My complete conversation with Rod Dreher is up at ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, Ralph Reed on Trump in the upcoming election.
He's been the most pro-life president in American history.
The Christian Outlook will be back in a moment. Stay with us. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. For many years, Ralph Reed was the youthful face of Christian engagement in politics as he ran the Christian Coalition in the 90s. While his media profile has been much lower of late, he continues to be a force behind the scenes. In his latest book, For God and Country, The Christian Case for Trump, looks ahead to the 2020 election. He spoke with Bill Bunkley on WTBN Faith Talk in Tampa Bay, Florida.
I tell you what, the time is now for you to be able to share through this book just this phenomenon. I mean, this is a phenomenon. You have worked with national leaders for decades. Walk us through first that and then how this relationship you developed with the president.
Well, I got to know Donald Trump. You know, you could say coincidence. You could say divine appointment. Either way, I got a call out of the blue from a reporter in 2011, early 2011, asking me what I thought about Donald Trump. And I happened to have seen him on Fox News the day before talking about his views on the issues and saying on national television, to my surprise, that he was pro-life and pro-marriage and pro-family and pro-Israel. I didn't find the pro-Israel part surprising, but I did not know the others. So I told this reporter, I said, look, if he runs for president, given his ability to self-fund, given his celebrity and name ID, if he runs as a pro-life candidate, he's going to get a fair hearing from evangelical Christians and other pro-life voters, and he could surprise a lot of people. And about 2 hours after I had that interview, my phone rang, and it was Donald Trump. I'd never met him or talked to him before in my life. I hadn't even seen the article yet. I mean, I don't know if he got Google alerts or what, but he literally cold called me on my cell phone. I to this day, I don't know how he got it. And he just came on the line, and he said, Ralph, this is Donald Trump, and I just wanted to thank you for the nice things you said. And I said, well, I want to thank you for what you said about being pro-life. I said, I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised. And that was the beginning of a friendship. I invited him to Faith and Freedom events, not only in Washington, but around the country. And he came and spoke. And people got to know him. So all that to say, Bill, when he rode the escalator down in Trump Tower in June of 2015, I also had a lot of other friends running for president. Two of them were from Florida, Jeb mm-hmm. Bush and Marco Rubio, two dear friends of mine.
Oh, yeah.
two men, by the way, that I think very highly of. But, you know, I had a lot of friends running for president, and I was for my friends. But I never had any reservations about Trump on the issues, not one. I knew him well. I considered him a friend. And the reason why I wrote the book was not primarily to defend him, although I do plenty of that in For God and Country. The reason why I wrote the book was to defend the faith community, because they've been smeared in really the most insulting ways. They've been called hypocrites, spiritual frauds. It's been said that they sold their soul for 30 pieces of silver and sold out the gospel in order to gain access to power. And nothing could be further from the truth. What happened was, they faced a binary choice between two candidates, one of whom was admittedly flawed and imperfect, Donald Trump, but who promised to be a champion on the issues they cared about, of life, of religious freedom, of appointing conservative judges to the courts, and of supporting the state of Israel. And the other of whom, Hillary Clinton, was not only deeply flawed, but under FBI criminal investigation during the campaign. An investigation that, by the way, was reopened 10 days before we went to the polls, mm-hmm. after early voting had begun in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And a candidate who was advancing, as these voters saw it, intrinsic moral evils, including abortion on demand, including pledging to appoint only judges to the courts who would vote for abortion on demand, including infanticide.
That's right.
And so faced with that binary choice, they made a tough call. It was a difficult choice. But, Bill, they made the right choice. And Donald Trump's record has vindicated their decision. He's been the most pro-life president in American history. He moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I've got a 30-page appendix on all of his accomplishments, including his accomplishments in advancing Christian principles and the pro-life and pro-family agenda. they made the right call, and they're going to vote for him in even bigger numbers in 2020.
Mm. One of the major themes of this book is promises made, promises kept. And boy, when you look at the abortion or the Planned Parenthood, you look at that particular rail. Unbelievable what this president has done. Comment on that.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I can't possibly in this format go through all the promises that Donald Trump made that he's kept. But let me just highlight a couple real quickly that I think will really resonate with your audience. The first is, and I think the one, as I argue in For God and Country, was decisive in his election, was we had a vacancy on the Supreme Court on Election Day 2016 after the untimely death of Justice Antonin Scalia, a conservative hero. Donald Trump was the first major party nominee in the history of our country to release a list of jurists in May of that year, initially 12, expanded later to 21. And he said that if he was elected president, he would choose one of those judges to take that vacancy, not someone who shared their philosophy, not someone like them, but one of those 21. He kept that promise with Neil Gorsuch. He kept it again with Brett Kavanaugh. He's appointed more federal judges as of today, over 400, and including over 50 appellate court judges and two Supreme Court justices. A second I'll mention real quick is his decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That was a promise that every president had made for over a quarter of a century. It's actually a federal law. Congress passed a law in 1996 compelling the moving of the embassy. But every president waived that law.
Yep.
And Donald Trump made that promise and kept it. And he gave us his word. He proved to be true to his word. And I, for one, am tired of people saying that he's devoid of character, because he gave us his word, not just Christians, but the American people, and he kept it.
Coming up, hope for our nation.
It begins from the bottom up. It begins with marriages, families, and parents. It begins in churches and in synagogues. It begins in communities and neighborhoods where we live. All of the seedlings of restoration begin in the home, in the neighborhood, and where we live and work.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. As we look out on American culture today, it's easy to drift to the feeling that there's little or no hope for our country. But we know that we ought to be a people marked by hope. Tim Gagline, a focus on the family, is seeking to give hope with his latest book, American Restoration, How Faith, Family, and Personal Sacrifice Can Heal Our Nation. He was a guest of Frank Sontag on KKLA in Los Angeles.
Frank, it's so tempting to say that this is, you know, the most divided we've ever been. And whether you're in an audience of liberals and progressives or conservatives and traditionalists, that's the temptation. But the reality is that Americans have been, in several hinges of history, very divided. You know, in the American Revolution, one-third of Americans did not support the revolution. You know, 750,000 people died in the Civil War. The social and moral revolution of the 1960s, major divisions over Vietnam and Watergate. So we have been, you know, divided before. Our politics has been poisonous. The largest historical question is, what is the way forward? What kind of a country do we want 50 years from now? And frankly, the issue that we raise in our book is, how do we restore the country? How do we renew and regenerate a really great country? What are the steps we have to take toward American restoration? And that's why we chose it as the title of our book.
You're emphatic and clear in your statement saying, look, let's be careful about what we buy into, especially as the way the mainstream media reports what's going on in our country.
Well, I think that's right. So, you know, we have a lot of challenges, needless to say, but I am absolutely a hopefulist to the core. I believe that America's best days are genuinely ahead of us, not because I'm a confetti-to-the-wind optimist. It's just, I believe that restoration and renewal and regeneration in a great country like ours even with all the difficulties, Frank, I do believe that restoration is probable. And the largest question, as I say, is how do we get there? This is the answer, if I may say, that our book, you know, seeks to answer. And the thing we decidedly do not do is we say it's not going to be a conservative version of a top-down fix like the Great Society, you know, or right. or the New Deal. It begins from the bottom up. It begins with marriages, families, and parents. It begins in churches and in synagogues. It begins in communities and neighborhoods where we live. All of the seedlings of restoration begin in the home, in the neighborhood, and where we live and work. You have to restore civility in the public square. In other words, we really can disagree agreeably. There's a way to do that, and we have to do it. Left or right is something that we have to have a national commitment to, because otherwise we will remain in a kind of cold civil war, and that's not decidedly worthy of a great country like the United States.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn, Alex Perez and Alex Garrett, I'm Kevin McCullough. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. She expected the world, but it flew away from her reach. So she ran away in her sleep.